Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Tap the Box with FETC Services, hosted by Billy Greenwood and friends. FETC Services. Average training breeds an average fire department. Let FETC help you achieve excellence. Now here's Billy.
Good evening. We'd like to welcome everyone tonight to Fire Engineering's Blog Talk Radio, hosted by FireEngineering.com. It is Wednesday, November 23rd, 2011, and it's 19:30 hours here Eastern Standard Time. You're listening to a radio show called Tap the Box, hosted by me, Billy Greenwood of FETC Services. Fire Emergency Training Consultation Services is located in Keene, New Hampshire, and FETC delivers advanced-level firefighter safety, survival, and leadership seminars throughout the United States. We also provide a small line of field-tested fire rescue-related equipment. So please take a moment and check out FETC Services at our website at www.fetcservices.com. This show is named Tap the Box, and it is the creation and sole opinion of the show's owner, me, Billy Greenwood of FETC Services. All rights are reserved. All personal opinions expressed or implied are just that, personal opinion of the show's owner, and not that of Fire Engineering Magazine, Fire Engineering Training Blog Network, the Penwell Corporation, or any governmental agency, association, or municipal fire department for which I am associated with. With that said, and keeping all my bosses happy, we'd like to welcome callers from all over the world tonight to call into Fire Engineering Talk Radio and participate in our conversation. We only request that the conversation remain cordial and professional at all times. The toll-free number to call in and be part of our show tonight is 1-877-497-3973. And one more time, that is 1-877-497-3973. Okay, this is Tap the Box, and we've got a really good show for you tonight. There's been a lot of great shows on Blog Talk Radio. There's been a lot of shows on tactics, extrication, really great stuff providing listeners of the Fire Engineering Talk Radio world with important information on the latest products, equipment that are available today. We at FETC Services always like to look at personal safety aspect of everything. While operating at motor vehicle collisions, we feel this is one of our target hazards that we can work better on. I think we all understand our personal safety, that my own, my crew, is the utmost priority during an emergency vehicle response and during operations at an incident scene. So tonight, we're going to discuss responder safety while working at or working in the roadway. We'll look at PPE, visibility, and advanced warning. But before we get into tonight's show, for those who followed us in the previous months, this is Blog Talk Radio show number 7 for FETC and Tap the Box. And for those who followed us, you guys understand that each and every show I use the same format, and we like to remind our listeners that this is a dangerous business. And if we look at some of the recent unfortunate activity over the past 30 days, we will be able to see and pay respect to some firefighters that were less fortunate than us. So looking at line-of-duty deaths since the last show to today, the USFA's Memorial Database is showing currently 79 line-of-duty deaths reported for 2011. And we're going to look at some of the individuals that had died in the last 30 days since our show. Louisville Volunteer Fire Department, Louisville Community, Ohio. Fire Chief Greg Baker, age 52. Fire Chief Baker responded to a structure fire and while working at a tanker fill site became ill. According to reports, Chief Baker was treated by fellow responders who placed him on a heart monitor and called for a medevac helicopter. Chief Baker was flown to Wheeling, West Virginia Hospital, where he passed away several hours later from an apparent heart attack. Roselle, New Jersey. Captain John Young, age 50. Captain Young was responding to a fire in his POV when he crashed. First responders performed CPR. He was transported to the hospital where a short time later he was pronounced dead. The cause of death, preliminary-wise, appears to be apparent heart attack while he was en route to the reported fire. Rossville, Pennsylvania. Fire Police Officer Ed Steffi, age 71. Fire Police Officer Steffi was responding to a vehicle accident. After arrival, he was directing traffic at the scene and began to feel ill and sat down in his vehicle. A few moments later, he went into cardiac arrest and passed away at the scene of the vehicle accident. Fairfax, Virginia. Firefighter Horace Pendergast, age 49. Fairfax County Rescue. Firefighter Pendergast was discovered deceased in bed by fellow firefighters at shift change, having passed away during the night in his sleep, and the cause is still to be undetermined. So let's take a moment and take a moment of silence and pay respect to these honorable men. May God and the Brotherhood take time to protect each of these men's families, friends, fellow co-workers. Your selfish act of courage, while in the act of duty to protect and serve the citizens of your community, will not be forgotten. May you rest in peace forever. Godspeed, brothers. Amen. Okay, industry news. Well, industry news, local news. Last month I had a good show on the inhalation hazards involving toxic chemicals in today's smoke. It also included NFPA 1582 physicals and firefighter cancer. We had Captain Steve McKenna on from the Salem Fire Department, and he had a personal story to share on his cancer diagnosis and his battle to beat the disease. During that discussion, I went on to speak about mesothelioma, a form of lung cancer for which is usually caused by exposure to asbestos. During that segment, I had originally planned and thought about bringing on a dear friend of mine named Captain Roland Prue. Roland's been a close friend and a fellow co-worker of mine for many, many years. He was diagnosed with mesothelioma, this form of cancer, 1 year prior. The interesting thing about it was he was a healthy guy. At the young age of 50, he was a non-smoker. He was not the person for what you'd expect to say, hey, I just got told I got cancer. He was a very quiet man who never complained about why me. He battled hard as he could for the past 12 months, and just before our show aired, he was told that it had spread to other parts of his body and that science could no longer afford a way to beat the disease. So my segment on mesothelioma was really all about him, and I wanted him to be part of the show. The same way that Steve was, and the way Steve told his personal story. But being just told his bad news, I didn't think it was fair to him and his family. Captain Prue died November 4th, 2011, after a well-fought battle of this disease. Though not a line-of-duty death, because our state does not have a heart and lung bill, his death was at the young age. He was a 20-plus-year active member of the fire service. My deepest thoughts, prayers, and wishes go out to Roland's wife, Robin, his two sons, and as they know, the department will truly miss Roly. But he will be forever in our hearts. Godspeed, Roland, until we meet again. Okay. Another little tidbit of industry news that we have to pay respect to is the Fire Service mourns the loss of a legend, leader Hal Bruno. Since our last show, we've lost Bruno. The Fire Service has lost one of its finest champions in passing of Hal Bruno. He was a firefighter for more than 60 years, a renowned columnist, and most recently the chairman emeritus of the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. He died Tuesday evening in Batesia, Maryland, from complications of a fall he had taken on Friday, November 4th. Hal was 83 years old. Bruno was appointed to the chairman of the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation in 1999, a distinction he held until he retired in 2008. During that time, according to the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, Bruno expanded services and resources for survivors, including workshops, conferences, and scholarships. He also developed many safety initiatives for firefighters and advanced safe practices to help reduce the number of line-of-duty deaths and injuries. Myself, FETC Services, we are a proponent of the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. We deliver the Courage to be Safe program. We've been involved with the 16 life safety initiatives for many years, and we've seen and heard Hal speak many times, and when he spoke, he was a person that everyone perked up and listened to. So out of remembrance of him, we're going to listen to him one more time, and it's going to speak directly towards the subject that we have going on.
Things that have to happen when a firefighter dies in the line of duty. We have to honor his or her memory. We have to pay tribute and tell the world of the sacrifice they made. But equally important, along with supporting their families, we have to take steps to prevent it from happening again. We have to find out which new lessons are to be learned and which old lessons went unheeded and caused this to happen. We must never take a firefighter's death for granted, even though we know that the work is inherently dangerous and that every year more names are going to go up on our memorial at Emmitsburg.
That was Hal speaking in the program that we deliver called The Courage to be Safe. It's part of the 16 life safety initiatives. If you haven't been involved in it, reach out to your state advocate. Contact the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. Ask who's your state advocate, and they will get someone in contact with you, and you can get your department on board with the 16 life safety initiatives. And that program goes above and beyond to deliver that program absolutely free to the local fire department. So out of respect for Hal, reach out, touch someone at National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. Okay, like I mentioned before, we here at FETC and Tap the Box are always looking to discuss firefighter safety issues, and we feel it's a good time to discuss roadway safety for first responders. So this is where we would announce our special guest co-host tonight. Unfortunately, my scheduled co-host is currently unavailable to call in and be part of our show. We all understand the calling of our jobs. He's currently tied up on a job and unable to break free. Hopefully it's a ripper and he's getting to battle the beast. Regardless, though, the show must go on, and we'll push through this little slight deviation to the program. Hopefully the listeners tonight will take up the slack, be part of our show. I know that many out there have had close calls or near misses of their own, especially working in the roadway. The roadway itself is a very dangerous place. So if you have a story or concern, we want you to call in. Okay, the number again is 1-877-497-3973. Get involved. Be part of tonight's delivery. Okay, so emergency response, highway safety. First thing I want to talk about is we have to drive appropriately for the conditions. We're up here in New Hampshire. We had a snowstorm back before Halloween. We had a snowstorm yesterday. We're going from bare dry roads to heavy, wet, thick, slushy snow. October conditions, we had over 20 inches in some parts. Firefighters need to be prepared for those slippery conditions. We're responding out to the roadway and mitigating motor vehicle accidents because the general public have forgotten how to drive in the winter. We should not be one of them. So slow ourselves down. Make sure the vehicle's ready in good working order, and our speed is a critical component of that. Can't help anybody if we don't arrive there. Next thing goes for emergency response would be the vehicle itself. If you have a Jake breaker, engine retarder, and slippery surfaces, those can create hazards on their own. Okay, so department policy and local protocol is what you got to lean on with a company officer, chief officers, and find out exactly how you're supposed to operate in those conditions. Okay? A lot of departments have policies and procedures that stuff needs to be all turned off, and we increase our following distance, increase our braking distance by responding slower. Okay. So safe vehicle positioning while operating in the road or near moving traffic. Very dangerous place. We've all had near misses out there. We all have stories. I'd like to hear people call in. Looks like I got a couple people on the line already. So before I get into really the nuts and bolts of this program, we're going to bring a caller on. Just like to remind all the callers, if you're listening via the computer and you're sitting in front of the computer with a phone, please turn the volume down, because when you get brought on the air, we're going to have a lot of feedback, and it'll feedback right through the computer speakers. So if you're listening while holding the phone to your ear and you're not in front of a computer, you won't have any of that feedback problem. So welcome to Tap the Box. Please state your name and where you're from.
Hello, Billy.
Yes.
Hey, this is Reese from North Carolina, western part of North Carolina. Just want
to
give you a shout out and thanks for the invite upon Tap the Box, and for our brothers that have gone on to the other side. And want to say to them and their families, you're still in our hearts, you're still in our thoughts and prayers. One thing I want to emphasize on your deal tonight, North Carolina has done the there's some laws going on right now as far as may have been passed in our state that mandate if you see an emergency vehicle approaching you, you are to move over. It's called a move over law. I don't know if y'all across the states have that same type law, but it's mandated in our it's mandated across in our state. If you see an approaching emergency vehicle, you know, you got to yield to them. It's called a move over law. Something else that I want to tap on tonight too is, as we're going to get into it a little bit later on tonight, is firefighter safety while you're on a scene. What things that we're going to be looking at as far as putting the apparatus, positioning the apparatus, having the cones out in different in the different lane as far as the same path, and how to space that out, and I'll get more involved in that with you if you'd like for me to, but just kind of give you some heads up. Also, they've also come out with new breakaway, or I'm not saying breakaway, tearaway traffic vest. You know, you've seen some traffic vest that does not have the ripaways, and that the reason why that some departments have already went to that is because we've had so many firefighters to get drugged down the road. If they would have had their rip-away vest on, they wouldn't have got drugged. And there's also some things that, you know, for me, I like to wear. I always get laughed at while I'm on a scene. Why should you wear your helmet? There ain't no fire. If I ever get hit, I don't want my brains splattered all over the interstate. So, wear your personal PPE, wear the correct one, wear your traffic vest the right way. I always put it over my turnout coat, and that also gives me more padding just in safe if I ever get hit, and God forbid. But, I just want to throw that in to Tap the Box tonight and see how y'all guys feel about different ideas. Go ahead, Bill.
All right, Reese. Well, first thing I want to say is thank you for calling in, Tap the Box. We appreciate all the callers who call in. You guys have a strong voice in the world. Everybody has good opinions, and they have good stories to tell, lots of experience from all different parts of the world. And, you tapped on the move over law, and you're right. There is a new law out, or a fairly new law out to most people, called the move over law. And I'm looking at a chart of the United States, and I'm looking at North Carolina. Your move over law code is 20-157. It clearly states requires drivers to reduce speed and vacate the lane closest to the stationary emergency vehicle. Identifies emergency vehicles as police, fire, rescue, or ambulance. And New Hampshire's got a move-over law as well. And ours is worded very similar. Reduce speed and vacate the lane wholly or partially by a blocked emergency situation. Requires drivers to give a wide berth to a stationary vehicle, including tow trucks. That's how our state's worded.
Mm-hmm.
But the move-over law is one of the things that has been put into place throughout most of the United States now. You can actually look at this chart, if you're truly interested, at respondersafety.com is where I've been looking at a lot of this information. It's a great website, www.respondersafety.com. It's got a wealth of information there to include everything that you talked about, Reese. So the move-over law is definitely something. Have you seen a difference in driver reaction or driver behavior and reaction since the move-over law has been put into place?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. But the only thing that really concerns me still, you've got if you meet somebody in a curve. Now, I don't know why, and I don't know why they do it, but they'll just freeze right up in the middle of a curve. And then everybody in the cab sort of like, well, get ready, hold on, because we don't know what we're going to meet on the other lane. So, more or less, is what you're saying. If we have over a 2,000-pound truck, all right, we already know that our fire trucks weigh over 2,000 pounds, maybe 200,000 pounds. Well, let's just throw that estimate in there. Well, you've got personnel that's inside there, dressed out, going to a call. Okay, say we're going to a wreck. All right, what does that give us the right to do over the speed limit? Because really and true honestly, there's no such thing as 10 miles over speed limit. Because, you know, you're going to get there to the call, but if something happens to you while you're in your rig, what good are you? I mean, you know, it's something where, you know, we've talked about in several business meetings at our fire department. When you enter into the cab, or before you enter into the cab, do a walk around. Calm down. I mean, and whenever you get in, seatbelt. We push seatbelts. Oh my goodness! Every time. I mean, and if it's not the driver, it's going to be the captain that's sitting in that chair, or the firefighter that's sitting in the captain's chair, saying, "Hey, before the driver needs to move out of the bay, he needs to ask, is every firefighter seatbelted?"
Right.
I'm going to go ahead and throw that in there, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
But all the way, Billy, is what good are we as firefighters if we don't get to the scene? And just be safe. I mean, that's what I've always heard. I mean, because we've always heard in our training, every firefighter wants to go home. Nobody wants to go to a hospital and see somebody with two broke legs, two broke arms, a busted head open because of carelessness. I have been told this many, many times when I get there, and this recently just happened. We have changed our bylaws. Say, for example, tree down across a roadway. You know you're not going, I mean, you know that you're not going to take a brush truck. You know you're not going to go screaming demon to a tree down because there's no life danger. There's no immediate danger. So why should you get into a brush truck and go, screaming down the road for a downed tree?
Absolutely.
So we changed that into our policy. Well, we go no lights, no siren.
Yep.
And before we roll out of the station, we'll do our walk around. Everybody's seat belted into the truck before the truck even rolls out on the apron.
Yep.
I mean,
good point.
You know,
very good points. The seatbelt one is a no-brainer, in my opinion. It's a no-brainer. They build fire trucks, they build passenger vehicles with built-in roll cage protection, and if you're not strapped in, you're not going to stay in. It's as simple as that. And when a vehicle rolls over and a firefighter gets ejected, it's a shame. It's an absolute shame. It's as simple as a department policy stating that the vehicle will not move without firefighters all seated, fully dressed, and wearing a seatbelt. Now, we just got some new apparatus recently where I work, and if you're sitting in the seat, there's a micro switch underneath the seat that knows that you're actually sitting in the seat.
Correct.
And if that seatbelt does not get clicked before the driver releases the air brakes or the maxi brakes, there's a huge warning alarm that goes off in the cab, and it tells the driver that somebody who's sitting in a seat hasn't clicked their seatbelt yet. It's a shame that industry standards are moving to that due to the fact that human behavior doesn't see the safety aspect of wearing the seatbelt. And I've heard every comment out there. Can't get dressed while wearing a seatbelt. I can't get my air pack on while wearing a seatbelt. Well, those types of behaviors are simple to fix. Put your gear on before you mount the cab.
That's exactly right. I agree 100% with that.
Then when you get into the cab, what we teach our probies is you put your arms through the shoulder straps of the SCBA if you got 911 seats. Once you've put your arms through those two straps, then you reach up and you click your seatbelt. While you're going down the road, you don't have to work your your arms underneath the shoulder strap of the seatbelt to get your SCBA taken care of. You can adjust your shoulder straps to the tension that you like, and you can slow yourself down and get ready to go. On arrival, you just got to hit the seatbelt button to release it, and you're coming out of the seat with your air pack on. But firefighters will tell you, I have a hard time getting the straps on and stuff.
There's too much stuff in the cab.
That's bogus. The firefighters need to put their arms through the straps before they put their seatbelt on. But it literally takes 5 seconds to do before that vehicle rolls. And you're right. The driver is truly responsible for the actions of the people in that cab. And we now have some characteristics and behavioral traits that the driver will actually speak up. Everybody belted, and if someone doesn't say yes, he doesn't move. And then he'll turn around and go, "We're going to sit here all night until you tell me that you're belted." I'll give you another example too. I worked for a full-time fire department, so I was on a SWAT. And when the policy first came out, if you understand my personality, I'm pretty much black and white. If there's policy in place, it's been written in for a reason, and it's usually for the better of the department. It's usually better for the mission statement that everybody follows that policy or that procedure. And the policy clearly stated what we just said: get fully dressed, fully donned, mount the truck, arms through the seat, seatbelt on, and you're going down the road. You're always wearing your seatbelt. So we're going down the road, and we're going to a car fire. It's a two-piece response. It's got two different stations responding at the same time. And I reach back while we're going down the road to say, "Tickets, please." And the tickets means I want everybody's accountability tag so that they reach them up and hand them to me. We don't have them all clipped into the truck before we arrive. We hand the tag to the officer riding in the right front seat as we're going down the road. And the seats are close enough where they can reach back over their head and just hand them to you. They don't even have to undo the seatbelt. So when I didn't get the second ticket from the tail person in the back, I turned my head to look towards the rear, and I noticed that the guy was putting his shoulder straps on. And I said to him, "Are you going to put your seatbelt on?" And he says, "I can't put it on. I have a difficult time putting it on while wearing a seatbelt." Clearly just didn't acknowledge the training behavioral trait aspect of put the shoulder straps on before the seatbelt come on. So I said to him, "You need to put that seatbelt on right now." And he goes, "I will, right after I get my SCBA on." So then I turned to the driver and I said, "Shut your lights off." He says, "What?" I said, "Shut your lights off." Now, I'm on a SWAT. This isn't my group. This is a different group of firefighters. And I said, "Shut your lights off." He goes, "What?" I said, "Yeah, shut your lights off." So we shut the lights off, and I turned back around. I said, "If you don't put your seatbelt on right now, we're going to pull over, and I'm going to call this truck out of service." We had two trucks coming. We got one coming from a different station. And the firefighter goes, "Are you kidding me?" I said, "No, I'm not kidding you." I said, "Then we're going to have to explain to the chief why we didn't make it first due to a car fire in our district and why the other station beat us." Next thing you know, the firefighter in the other seat says, "Put your damn seatbelt on. I want to go to the fire." You know, so peer pressured the guy in. And the guy put his seatbelt on when he realized that I wasn't going to give up on it. And riding in that right front seat comes with responsibilities. It's not a position for you to be their friend, to be their mother. It's your job to be their supervisor. And oftentimes that type of behavioral dynamic between the supervisor and a firefighter can be uncomfortable, and it's not for everyone, but that's the way things need to be. If that vehicle got into an accident and that firefighter flew across the cab, come crashing into me or come crashing into the firefighter that was sitting opposite of him, the guy that's actually seatbelted in is going to take the brunt of a 150, 200-pound, 225-pound guy. And you know what? More than likely, the one that was strapped in with the seatbelt is the one that's going to get really banged up or die. And then you're going to have to explain to that family why their husband or their wife died while wearing their seatbelt because the partner sitting next to them chose not to. And that could be a pretty shitty day.
I agree 100%, Billy.
The policies are there for a reason.
That's right. And I agree with that. I mean because, you've got different types of apparatus. You've got the ones that have with no nose, that's just flat.
Oh, conventional cab over.
I mean, you've got a big big window, and if, lo and behold, if I'm, I don't want to go through that big window. So, you know, before I go in, if I ever sit up front, then my little backside's going to have a seatbelt on.
Hey, you mentioned breakaway, the ANSI breakaway traffic vest. Did you guys implement that high visibility standard when it came out, and did you buy just enough vests for the seats, or did you buy one for every firefighter so you can wear it on your gear?
Everybody.
Very nice.
Everybody has them. I travel
around a lot, and we teach a lot, and when I travel around, I always like to look at how they set their stuff up organizationally wise. And, you know, if you've got a big fleet of apparatus, sometimes buying a vest and setting it on each back of every seat affords you just about the same number of vests than it would be to assign one personally to each firefighter and tell him to put it on his gear before you go on the call. And then if you have a fire call where you're going to wear your SCBA, you can just break away the Velcro tabs and wear your air pack without it underneath you. But the luxury of wearing it the way that you guys have is the fact that it takes away the behavioral trait of the firefighter saying while they're going down the road, it's too hard to put the vest on while we're wearing my seatbelt going down the road, or when they get to the accident scene, jumping out of the truck and trying to don it, just getting out of the cab in such a hurry that oftentimes I've seen a few, because the Velcro, when they're kind of scrunched up in a ball for each seat, they can tend to get all bunched up, and when you go to put one arm in, you can't find the other hole. So I've seen firefighters give up on it. So departments who have bought or purchased the ANSI high visibility vest and given one to each individual firefighter and told them to put them on their gear has had a greater percentage of firefighters wearing them all the time. And, you know, when you go to an actual response where you're going to wear your air pack and you go into a response that's actually has a fire or a fire hazard, you can break those things away fairly quickly before you don the pack and come off the truck. So I think that what you guys have done is a wonderful thing. I think that's the policy that I'd like to see a lot of places go to. And that way there it takes away the characteristics of possibly saying, well, it's too difficult to do, or I'm just lazy, you know, so...
Well, another thing that I want to tap on the box too tonight too is this too, Billy. I mean, it's a good thing for, say, for example, if you're doing water shuttle. Even though that there are guys that are not going to be out there that are on the main fire scene, they're back shuttling back and forth water to us. You know, these guys need to have. Those guys need to have their traffic vest on too, because car comes down the road, you don't have it on, and some of the turnout gear that we have out here, you're not going to be very visible. So just, you know, put your traffic vest on, wear your helmet whenever you get out of the truck. I mean, you know, and just don't wear it. I'm talking about chin straps up underneath the chin, too. Even though if you're doing water shuttle, too. I know a lot of people's going to disagree with what I just said. But, you know, if you get hit and your head hits the ground before that helmet does, there's something wrong.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, because, you know, then you're going to end up going to the hospital with head trauma.
Yeah, it goes from a minor injury to a major head injury.
Exactly. So, you know, I'm just going to tap this out there to Block Talk tonight and see what y'all think. Even though that you're doing water shuttling on a back and to and from a fire scene, have your PPE on, have your chin strapped up underneath your chin, and then have your traffic vest on, because there has been, I do know of this, in one of our county, a guy stepped out of his apparatus as soon as he stepped out of his apparatus, a car almost hit him.
Yep.
And so, you know, and also thank goodness for the new, I'm going to just throw this in too, the new Chevron on the back of the trucks now too, the visibility on the Chevron.
Yep.
With this, matter of fact, you were talking about getting new vehicles. We're talking about where the seat belts, whenever you sit in the seat, it goes off. We've got one of those trucks, and it drives the driver crazy. He said,
yep.
Well, I wish we could unhook it. No, you don't.
Yeah, everybody sit down and put the seatbelt on and won't go off.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, the Chevron's in the new standard in the industry. There's a lot of reluctancy for people to say, I like that, due to the fact that tradition, we don't see a lot of neon high yellow on the back of fire trucks. And so, you know, you get some of the traditionalists and old-timers that say, that looks like, you know, looks like crap. It looks terrible. But to be honest, at nighttime when you're approaching that from a low light hazard or tired, drivers today are distracted. You know, they're texting, they're talking on the cell phone. Heck, the new phones now are basically computers in your hand. You got people on those things that are watching YouTube videos and movies because they got a basically a palm computer in their hand and they're distracted. You know, the old days we used to laugh about people that were reading a book while going down the highway, physical, you know, hardcover book. But today with these computers, everybody has, you know, an iPhone or something like that. They got a computer in their hand now instead of a cell phone, and that creates a greater distraction hazard as well. So, yay. Hey, Reese, I appreciate you calling in. Why don't you hold on the line and listen in for a little longer, and then when you feel that you got something to add, we'll jump right back in, okay?
All right. Thanks, sir.
All right. All right, so we're going to look at safe positioning. I'd like to understand if your department has an SOP or an SOG and talk specifically about some of the terms. If you don't, once again, going to respondersafety.com. I'm not affiliated with them. I don't have any monetary value with them. It's a resource that's been put together, and it has everything there. It has everything from PowerPoint programs, videos, a sample SOG, which I'm holding in front of me, with all the terminology. And you run an in-house training program, and you review all the terminology, and you look at the actual accident scene and traffic control, and it's eye-opening. You know, it's eye-opening. We're looking at the average general public and the estimated stopping distances. And if you've got not a highway or a throughway, but let's just say a motor vehicle route that has a 55-mile-an-hour speed zone, the average stopping distance is 495 feet. For the general public to jam the brakes on at that speed and make sure that they don't strike the back of that accident scene or a person that's standing out there potentially trying to direct traffic. So, you know, going back to the high-visibility vests, if you're wearing black gear, the reflex light that's on some of that black gear is minimal. If you even have the most overzealous fire chief that has, you know, four wraps on your legs and four on your wrists, it still doesn't add up to the high-vis vests when you look at some of the videos that are on this website. And they do. They have police officers wearing vests, police officers not. They have firefighters wearing vests, firefighters not. And they're taking a still photo from a distance away. And you can clearly see firefighter with the vest, firefighter without. So keeping that in mind, it's very important. The sample SOG talks about apparatus positioning, blocking buffer zones, upstream, downstream, and then the taper, okay? And taper is very important because we need to get out with advance warning well out before the accident scene. So one of the things that I'd like to talk about is what do people respond to a motor vehicle accident with? Are we responding with big fire trucks only? Do we allow in the volunteer world, are we allowing POVs to respond out to the accident scene? And do those POVs afford us with protection or with the protection that we think we need? When you get to see some of these videos and this traffic control program that they offer, you can see police cars that get punted. They get punted like a football, and they don't afford much safety. All right, well, we got another call here. We're gonna go to the phone again and pick up on another caller here from New Hampshire. Welcome to Tap the Box. You're on with Billy, and this is tonight's show. What's your name and where you're from? Hello, you're on Tap the Box. Hello, caller, are you there? Looks like they just dropped them. So, all right, well, getting back to apparatus positioning. One of the things that is interesting and to look at, like I said before, is the POV response. And back a long time ago, many moons ago, when I was a volunteer, I was directly involved in a post-secondary collision with a vehicle striking my POV. And my POV was positioned appropriately in the transition area, if you were going to go through the program, meaning I was heading up the road, came across the accident that we were dispatched to. I was responding from home, obviously. I had to pass the accident scene to go to the fire station. We had a policy at the time that everyone went to the fire station, donned their equipment, their gear, boarded the truck, and took a fire department emergency response vehicle to the accident scene. The only deviation from that was that if you had to pass the incident location, meaning the house that was on fire or the motor vehicle accident, that you had the affordability to stop and render assistance. And then when the emergency apparatus arrived, you could join up with them. So I had a motor vehicle collision that was about a half mile down the road from my house. I lived about 4 miles away from the fire station. I got up and responded down the road, came across the accident, called it in, sized it up, gave an incident report, established command, pulled past the accident scene because the accident scene was in the southbound travel lane and I was heading northbound. So I drove past it, pulled over onto the wrong side of the road, parked my pickup truck at the appropriate, like, 30-degree angle. I had red lights flashing at the time, and it was set up at an angle, so it created the transition or the angle deflection if something hit it. Local PD had arrived just minutes after I arrived and positioned just in front of my vehicle. He was coming down the southbound lane as well. So we had blue lights and red lights in the transition area. We did not have any advance warning beyond probably 50 or 60 feet because it was the first vehicle there. Later on, after I got out of the vehicle and we were working on patients that were that had struck the utility pole, identified that we didn't have any hazards with the pole wasn't cracked, we didn't have any hazards with the wires, deemed that the area was safe enough to leave vehicles and the patient inside the vehicle. It was winter time, obviously, and started to render care. I had a vehicle come around the corner, which had probably 500 feet of advance warning. So if you came around the corner, you would have 500 feet before you saw the back of the police car. And when the vehicle was coming, you sounded like it was coming awful fast with lights and sirens. And later on was determined that they thought the vehicle accident was further south than where it actually was. When they made the corner, looked down the road, and they're bum puckered. Stepped on the brakes, and the black ice that had caused the original accident now had this vehicle sideways. So it was sliding southbound in the southbound lane, but it was coming down sideways like a bowling ball. We actually had enough time to grab the victim, the police officer, and there was another single person there as a bystander, and move from the roadway and get off into the shoulder and into the break, well off the shoulder and off what I would call the woods or the tree line. as the vehicle came down and proceeded to strike the police cruiser and my personal vehicle. Never struck the actual vehicle that was the original accident due to the deflection, but absolutely destroyed multiple vehicles. Later on, if that vehicle or those vehicles weren't positioned there, it clearly would have come in and struck the original accident and all the emergency responders that were there. So the vehicles were positioned appropriately, but due to the fact that my vehicle was a personal vehicle and the local police department was involved as well, then the state police had to come so that we didn't have any contradicting investigation and police report. It was later identified that, dependent upon your state's law, is a personal vehicle considered an official emergency responding vehicle for the fire department. The next thing that was quickly identified to me was that my personal motor vehicle insurance did not know that I was a volunteer. And where I was insured, they informed me that volunteer firefighters would have had a higher rate. They need to know that we also have a light card, meaning that the personal vehicle was afforded the luxury of running an emergency light in our state, which would be red, and also being used for official department business, meaning it wasn't just personal use. So long story short, I ended up not being insured by them anymore due to the fact that they did not like the idea without being informed, and I was dropped. Quickly realized that emergency light really did not make a difference in the world as far as emergency response. As we spoke about earlier before, when we're responding to and from an incident, you have to arrive to the incident successfully in 100% capacity and not get involved in an accident along the route. And then my personal opinion was that if I was using that light, I was creating additional hazards by people yielding to me, potentially passing them, maybe not even breaking the speed limit, but passing them for people that actually yielded to me. The other thing that that happens is people are unpredictable when you come up upon them with an emergency light. A lot of times I felt people didn't understand why was there in my case, a black pickup truck with a red light on, and were they a fire department vehicle or was this just somebody with a crazy light on top? Dependent upon travelers that are traveling through your local town or state, they're coming from areas that might not have POV responses. And then they become very unpredictable. So it created greater hazard. And later on, I actually got to get educated more. I sat through a program, and an instructor said, if it takes you an additional minute to arrive at the scene successfully, the victim and the victim's family will never know that it took you an additional minute. If you are responding to a scene and you push the envelope to try to get to the incident a minute quicker and never arrive due to the fact that you got into an accident or died, they will never forget you. And that type of mentality makes sense due to the fact that the light really doesn't create that great of it doesn't create an increased response where we get there quicker. Oftentimes when we display it, even in a big fire truck, we travel at or just above the local speed limit, and then when we come up upon people who then have to try to figure out yielding to the vehicle in the move over law, oftentimes people are yielding on the right, sometimes people are yielding on the left. It creates a hazard that's unpredictable and ultimately slows us down. There's been many studies out there about emergency responses going with the flow of traffic, dependent upon the severity. And I know in our state, with the enhanced 911, we do have call coding, and quite oftentimes we will go to specific types of what the public calls emergencies. We deem more as a service call with the flow of traffic. And in our state, they've gone as far as to say in an emergency vehicle, including the ambulance, once you arrive on the scene and that patient has been deemed either stable or been stabilized by the emergency response crew, that that transport from the home or from the work site or from the residence to the emergency room with a stable patient will be flow of traffic response. The lights themselves, studies have shown, are creating some hazards that we, as emergency responders, are creating. So with that said, that's my little story on that. Another one that's quite interesting is the fact that when your local fire chief in the volunteer world, at least in our area, they give you a light card that gives you permission to actually display a warning light. And what I found out later on from the state police investigation was that light card is only honored in your town or your municipality that the fire chief is authorized to issue it for. So if you border a larger city or municipality that has a paid or full-time fire department that does not have volunteers, that local municipality does not have to honor you racing through their town with lights and sirens on to get to a call in your town. So we then, later on in my volunteer organization, had a policy internally to make sure that everyone understood that if you were shopping in the city and you were going to respond back to an alarm or a fire, that you weren't allowed to actually display lights or use your siren until you broke the town line and you were in our own jurisdictional area. So, all right, well, we're at the midway point here. I'd like to remind everybody that Tap the Box is looking for callers to call in, and if you would like to do that, it's as simple as calling in on an 800 number, toll-free. So don't be afraid to pick up the phone. That number is 1-877-497-3973. So let's play mid-station commercial from Fire Engineering. You're listening to Happy Services, host Billy Greenwood. Happy Services, located in New Hampshire, offer fire, rescue, safety, and survival courses throughout the United States. Check us out at www.happyservices.com. Services. And tonight we're talking about emergency responder safety while operating within the highway or roadway. So I'm going to bring on Reese again here. He's been on hold. We've got another question here. So I'd like to welcome Reese back to the show.
Thank you, Mr. Greenway.
Reese, what have you thought about POV responses to and from incidents involving accidents on the roadway? What's your belief or policies that you have there?
Well, first and foremost, here again, we're going to go back to where the time is going to be called for us to be dispatched. If it says motor vehicle accident, say, for example, our local, there's a highway that runs in our district, then what we do is this, is everybody comes to the station first. We pack out the trucks. Then five can sit in the main engine. Two can sit in the, which we call service truck. Just got extrication tools, extrication equipment on it, oil dry, that type of stuff. Pack out your trucks first before you go and be more of a nuisance. I'm going to just say that. But you don't want to clog up your incident scene as more than you have to. And I've sat back and I've said this time and time again during our training meetings. You know, we don't need to be 4 or 10 or 15 POVs out on an interstate, because North Carolina looks at it like, well, okay, well, then if you're going to be there for a long period of time, then DOT has to be called in. Then what they have to do, they have to, however your apparatus is, it's going to be towards the shoulder of the right, and you got the you got your emergency, what we call the emergency lane. Then you have your shoulder. Then you have your wooded area. If the car is off, like more or less run off the roadway, then put your apparatus there, right there, at an angle on the shoulder of the road, like it's pointing outward, and then have your cones stationed in behind it. But keep your POVs down to a minimum. I mean, because the more you got on a scene like that, it just causes more headache and more, more work for the guys, more or less, and a safety thing for the guys. So that's one thing we have to look out for.
Okay. Well, do you, looking at how you're operating now, do you position the truck, if we're coming up from behind the accident scene, do you position the truck that's going to provide the block? You said you angle that. Do you angle it so that the nose is towards the breakdown lane or towards the woods, or do you angle it so that the deflection from the car that strikes your engine deflects the secondary collision into the oncoming traffic? Do you nose it towards the center line, or do you nose it towards the woods?
I'm going to have to do a drawing right here on my desk. you got your engine, the car's off the roadway, it's not an impeding traffic, but yet you don't want over a 200,000 pound truck, especially if it's raining, you don't want to get stuck.
So, yeah, you don't want to get it off the road.
Right, you don't want to get it off the road, but what we want to do is you've got your reflections, reflections in the rear. You want to keep that visible. You want to keep that visible at all times. So what I would do is I would point, and it's just different how on an interstate. But there are some videos that we've watched during class how to operate. In class and operate on the fire scene.
Yeah.
That shows you how to position your apparatus while you're on the scene of an accident.
Yeah.
All right. Well, do you want your ambulance or your ambulance to come in behind the engine? No. You want them to come beside the apparatus to go right in front.
Yes.
That way they can pick up the patient and then go right on straight out.
Absolutely.
To the scene. instead of having everything in behind. And then what they have is like you'll have your area coned off, is what I call a switchback, just from switching from that lane to another lane to keep it flowing, but also having to making sure that nobody comes flying down through there. Because
right.
one person steps out and has to go, say for example, to go get another tool off the truck, you know, you want to keep people, you know, to keep this having the signs out, keep slow, that type deal.
Right.
But main thing is taking that engine that you're going to be using, implement that where that chevron is. If I'm coming down the interstate, I want to see that chevron right in my face. So more or less is just take the truck, position it. That way you've got that shield from your patient. You've got the shield that's from your firefighters that are working to maybe have to extricate the patient, that type deal. And your staging of your medical unit. That way, whenever they get ready to, and they've already packaged the injured person on the stretcher, they don't have to go and impede and walk out in the middle of the highway just to get in their vehicle.
Right. What I teach when we teach the program is ideally a three-piece response. The first vehicle provides protection for the block, or what we call the block in that lane, so that initially as traffic is coming up on the accident scene, that the fire truck is blocking the lane, and we usually angle it a little bit so that the deflection is not going to, if a car comes down the road and strikes the fire truck that's blocking, if you have the vehicle squared up so that the only thing that the public sees is the back of the truck, it's not very wide. So we tend to, or I tend to teach, that you nose it towards the breakdown lane on like a 30-degree angle so that you still can see the back of the truck and all the chevrons. But if they were to come in and strike the back of that truck, they would get deflected not into the oncoming traffic head-on, but it would deflect them off into the woods on the breakdown lane side. And then the crew steps off that vehicle, and if it's a open cab, everybody steps off on the protected side of the block closest to the accident. And sometimes the driver or the officer, who doesn't have that luxury, will have to step out, but they can look before they open the door, and then quickly come around and get behind the vehicle on the protected side, and then walk up to the accident that's occurred in front of them. And then the driver's responsibility when he exits the vehicle is to then go from his vehicle back towards the traffic that's approaching his vehicle. So he's walking towards the traffic that's coming at him, and he is placing the cones as he comes out to create the taper. So we start from the lane that we're blocking, and we work from that line, and we taper it back so that it's on an angle. And depending upon the speeds, if we're working in a 40-mile-an-hour zone, then the taper is going to take approximately 300 to 320 feet. It's going to take the driver about 8 cones to do over the distance. And then at the very end, when he's at his last cone, that taper should be almost to the breakdown line or the edge line, so that as the traffic's coming, they now have a wedge that says, okay, this lane's closed, they got to move over. At that cone, he walks out another 50 feet and undoes the retractable stand that has the fluorescent pink sign that says emergency scene ahead, and that would be the initial signage that the public or the traveling public would see. And then from there to the fire truck that's blocking the lane, there would be, in this case, in a 40-mile-an-hour zone, there would be at least 8 cones that had people move over before they got to the fire truck. And then when he comes back to the truck, he picks up some more cones and works down the lane that's closed past the cars that have crashed, and he continues on until they're past the accident scene, and then traffic can move back over in the lane that's blocked. Incident commander is responsible for placement of all the apparatus from that point forward. If the fire truck gets there and the officer in that truck is the incident commander on arrival, because it's the first arriving unit, the company officer would then place the ambulance, which I call downstream, meaning they come up to the back of the fire truck, they move over with the general public, they go past the accident scene, and they move over, and they are just after the accident scene, positioned so that they can drive away. But they're also positioned so that that vehicle is in the lane that's closed, and
correct,
there's no need for them to walk out into the travel lane. And oftentimes you see pictures of ambulances where they have to, they extricate a victim, they put them on the cot, they roll them up the road, they have to go around the block to bring them back to the ambulance that's before the blocking vehicle, which there's no protection when they're loading the back of the ambulance. So position the ambulance downstream, past the accident scene, get them in the block lane, and then if you actually have an apparatus, if you have an incident where it's going to require extrication, the engine that provides the initial block needs to come back enough so that they're not right on top of the hazard of the accident scene and provide room for the rescue, if you have a rescue company that's coming in, to come around and do the same thing that the ambulance would, but instead of going past the accident scene and then pulling in below the cars that were involved, they would come around the fire truck that's blocked, and they would tuck in just after the fire truck so that they are now just approached the original accident, and they are now working in that protected buffer space or work incident area, and they can stretch their hoses in lines and operate on the extrication thing. If that engine is the protection piece that needs to stretch a line due to we have a car fire, or if they need to stretch a protection line due to the extrication process, it's easier for the engine crew, once they've created the block and the driver has created the taper and the advance warning, for them to stretch a 200-foot line, and if they're still short, they can stretch another 50 feet or stretch a 200-foot line and then stretch off another 100 feet so that they can go around the rescue and bring that line all the way up to the scene. The rescue company does not have that luxury with predetermined reels for a extrication tool, or they wouldn't want to be carrying the pump and their short hoses and the rescue tool around the engine to get to the accident scene so that they could then operate the tool. So I create the buffer space before the blocking engine and the actual car accident. We increase that a little bit so that I can get the rescue company in that space into that incident working area. It also puts two vehicles before the moving traffic that are fairly big and heavy. If something was to come down the road and knock over the advance warning sign, blow through all the cones, and then strike the engine, the likelihood of it going through the engine and the rescue to get to the accident scene where all my personnel are working is slim to none, unless they step out of that. The other thing that I always preach when the firefighters are in the class is if they happen to be the engineer or the driver operator of the blocking vehicle, whether it's an engine or a ladder truck. Some departments send ladder trucks out on the highway to provide the block because they're bigger. When they walk upstream towards the traffic and they're placing cones, it is one of the most dangerous times for that driver. But it's a single person walking, and hopefully as they're walking head onto the traffic, they're paying attention to the cars coming at them, and if someone appears to be daydreaming and looking at a fire truck that has flashing lights, that they can step off to the side or jump off to the side. When they get to the end of the taper so that they're now going to place the emergency response sign that states, you know, emergency scene ahead, the advance warning signage. Once they place the sign, they need to take a peek back as if they were the traveling public. And here's the key to success. If the driver looks back and he can see any of the firefighters or any of the rescue crew or the ambulance extricating patients from inside the incident work area, or what I call behind the block, which is the shadow, then either the blocking vehicle is positioned inappropriately, or it wasn't angled enough to get enough coverage. if you can see where the firefighters are working, then technically a car can come down there and pick up the spare and bowling by taking out the workers that are working there. When we're doing an extrication and firefighters are backboarding patients, we don't want to have them get clipped. We don't want to have them sticking out just a little bit into the roadway or even on the breakdown lane side where the public can come down through and get distracted and clean out the emergency responders in a post-secondary accident. So those are the kind of things that I like to reiterate. And then we're looking at, you know, a 55-mile-an-hour zone on the highway. The transition area from the block until the end of the or to the beginning of the advance warning sign, we're looking at 660 feet. It's 16 cones. Not many fire departments carry 16 cones in the compartment of a fire engine. When they take the class and you talk about work areas and transition areas in the advance warning that's needed to provide safety, and our safety is the utmost priority. So fire chiefs, if you're going to do something in the future, you can easily get traffic cones from the highway department. It costs you nothing.
That's right.
And you might have to drop, you know, $100 for the advance warning sign that's the big fluorescent pink sign, but it's worth the $100 as long as the firefighters use the equipment. And you have to have a policy and procedure to make sure that firefighters understand what it is, provide them with the training. And if you get that sign out and the cars come along and they hit that with their headlights, that's the advance warning long before you get to your fire truck. And I know some places that will place a police car out there. The blue lights oftentimes create additional distraction. They're very blinding if they're the newer lights. And then once they go past there, if you have an elderly person driving, their eyes take time to adjust from the bright lights, and they might start, you know, driving through your cones that are a part of the taper. Next thing you know, they're coming up and smashing the back of the fire truck. And people are like, how did you miss the fire truck? And oftentimes, if the people survive from that accident, say, I was distracted. I couldn't see where I was going. And by the time I realized where I was going, I was striking the back of that fire truck. Or missing the fire truck and striking the people that are not working behind the shadow of that block. So those are the kind of key points that I like to stress when we teach the class. It is vitally important to make sure that we have the high visibility vests on. But if we are all working appropriately, the high visibility vests should provide us with protection when we are first creating the block, when we're first creating the taper, and placing out the advance warning. When we're operating at the incident scene, the high visibility vests should be all within that shadow until the public actually moves over one lane and slows down and passes the accident scene. Then people are going to look over and actually notice that everybody's got high visibility vests on. But if the driver, when they're placing that equipment out, you know, 500-600 feet from the back of their fire truck, when he can look back and see high visibility vests, you know, like a swarm of bees all around the car accident, then our block and our taper is inappropriate. It's not right, and something needs to be corrected. So, but that's, you know, that's how that I teach the class. It's a good way to assure that it's being done appropriately. We joke in hazmat that how close do you pull up to the incident scene when you have a chemical release, and a lot of people will hold their thumb up and go, if I can cover it with my thumb, I'm far enough back. If I can't cover it with my thumb, I got to back up a little bit. And that's kind of the same philosophy. If the driver of that truck can look down the road and see the accident scene behind his fire truck that's created in the block, then the block is inappropriate. So what do you think about that, Reese?
That's good. That's good. And more safety and just more or less just do the right thing and do the appropriate thing at the same time that it's given to you. I mean, you know, there's only one thing that it always throws back in my mind about a friend of mine that got hurt, and then it turned out that he passed away because he got hit. Because he stepped out of the, I call it the hot zone, and he stepped out of the cool zone into the hot zone, and a tractor trailer hit him, and then the next thing you know, we had two major events that was going on We had to deal with the initial call that came out. Then we had to go in, and our brother got hurt. And then something happened while he was in the hospital, and he passed away. So, you know, we got a main thing is what I've heard for years and years and years. Slow down. Think about how you're going to handle that call. Think about what, you know, okay, what am I going to do when I get on that call? What's my first initial size up? And this main thing is this, Billy, is just slow down.
Absolutely.
I mean, we're, just like I've heard in the past, we're hurting too many firefighters. I mean, you sit back and you look at it, the insurance, and I hate to say this, but the insurance frowns on firefighters for, you know, not doing the right thing and thinking that they are, but, you know, they're going to ask a question, well, whenever he got out of the truck, did he have his safety vest on? Was he protected? Was he working in the cool zone? What was he doing? Was he goofing off, or was he just? I mean, you know, we just got to step back and just mainly this. What I've heard and what I'm saying now to my guys, you know, just slow down and just take a breather.
I mean, absolutely.
And just think. I mean, the good Lord up above gave us a brain and gave us enough common sense, you know, to take on this profession. Because number one, we're out here to save lives and we're out here to protect property. But it didn't give us no right to go out and act like a bunch of Comanches.
Yep.
I mean, you know, you gotta. We got to slow down and just do the right thing, like I was saying, and this when we get on the scene, you know, position our trucks the right way, not aggravated, but people talk to me all the time. Why are you wearing your chin strap? Just like I said here a few minutes ago. If I get hit and my head goes to that pavement, or if I go to the ground, I want something that's going to protect my head, something that's going to protect this noggin of mine.
Yep.
I mean, you know, and positioning, I go with this again, and I'm going to say this. It's more or less, it's up. I'm going to back up before I end up saying something, but it's the driver's responsibility each and every time when he gets behind that wheel of that vehicle to not only take care of him, five other guys or six other guys, and take care of the equipment that's in that truck, but also take care of what is on the outside of that truck. So if we go, once again, speeding to a call, and, you know, just for say, you know, the tone's dropped right now for me. I'm not going to go and get in my car and drive 65 miles an hour in a 35 mile an hour zone just to get to that call, and I've got my red light going and everything else. Yeah, I understand that the adrenaline's flowing. You want to get to the call. You want to help your neighbor. I understand that. But the point of it is, slow down, because you'll never know. If this is during the daytime, you'll never know if a child is out. And this has happened here about a couple of years ago. It was a couple of years ago that a firefighter was responding to a call in his personal vehicle. A child was out playing basketball in his own yard and the ball rolled down the driveway, well, that child went after that ball. Well, that firefighter accidentally hit that child.
Yeah, he didn't have the intent. The issue was he probably couldn't slow down in time.
So, you know, every time, whenever we're going to and from a call, slow down and think, you know, because think about the good perspective of what you're going to be doing in your community. Because if that happens, you know, and you hit something and you're going to a call.
Yeah, it's irreparable damage with the public's trust.
Right, and then the public frowns on that.
Yep.
And then, you know, and then here we go with public image.
Yep.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So, you know, just that in a nutshell.
I think your points are well taken. You know, the good Lord put us on the earth with everything we need to be successful. It takes a positive attitude. It takes a firefighter to understand his policies and procedures and to slow himself down and curb that adrenaline rush so that they don't get caught up in the moment. And we have to slow down and arrive alive to help anybody. And that's very important stuff. I want to thank you for calling in tonight and being part of the show. And we look forward to speaking with you in the future, okay?
Thank you.
All right.
And also thank you for the invite and all the rest of my brothers out there. Be safe and enjoy the rest of the show.
All right, Reese. Very good. Have a good night.
Sir.
Okay. Well, we're getting to the end here. I'm going to go over some safety benchmarks that are on my my objective sheet here. Just want to make sure that we pass that along. And then once again, this is right straight from the University of Extrication, the Safe Parking SOP. It's a sample SOP SOG that's located on respondersafety.com's website. So here's a couple of safety benchmarks that we should make sure that we meet every time that we go out and work in the roadway. First one's never trust the approaching traffic. Always avoid turning your back to the approaching traffic. Establish the initial block with the first arriving emergency vehicle and fire apparatus. Always, always, always wear your Class 3 high visibility reflective vest during daylight and nighttime operations. That instills the behavioral traits of wearing it. We should always wear our structural helmet. Just like our guest there, Reese, had mentioned, if we do take a tumble, if we get clipped, get knocked down, our structural helmet protects us from having a minor head injury from becoming a major internal head injury. Wear full protective clothing, plus the highway safety vest at all vehicle-related emergencies. Okay, very important. Even in the hot weather operations and stuff, good policies and procedures are in place to make sure that we do not get hurt. If we're wearing all of our PPE and turnout gear, it affords us the benefit of if we do get hit and knocked down, if a line bursts, if we get hit by a car and dragged, the gear is going to provide us with greater protection than just wearing our normal clothing with a emergency or EMS jacket and no helmet, okay? Turn off all sources of vision impairment to the approaching motorists at nighttime incidents, including possibly the headlights and spotlights. Very, very cognizant. If we establish a safety officer at highway motor vehicle accidents and collisions, the safety officer should be looking at not only the safety aspects of the responders, but we should be looking at the safety aspect of impairment, and it could be that we are creating it. A lot of apparatus have the capability or engineer design that when we put on the emergency brakes, it shuts off the opticom, shuts off certain lights, so that if we do have a collision on the roadway and we're working on an incident scene, that we're not impairing the general public that's traveling in the opposite direction. Cautious, and be a word of caution to the spotlights and these new tower lights. Positioning of apparatus with these tower lights that light up a football stadium, incredibly bright, but incredibly dangerous when it's in the travel lane due to the fact that you have to understand who you're blinding at their level. And if you're standing at the incident scene, you might not think that it's impairing you. If you take a walk 50, 75, 150 feet away from that accident scene and turn back towards the accident scene, you cannot see anything in front of your face. So turning them away from the scene, lighting up the area, but not lighting up the area directly at the scene or at the angle for which is going to blind traveling public. Use fire apparatus in police vehicles initially to redirect the flow of moving traffic until you establish your taper, buffer zone, and advanced warning procedures. Establish advanced warning and adequate transition area for traffic control measures upstream of the incident to reduce the travel speeds long before they reach the accident scene. If you think about construction crews that are working on the highway, they do have accidents. But think about the total time of exposure that they have on that roadway and the number of cars that pass them in between accidents. We're looking to operate in the roadway 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and we're looking to provide protection for our personnel in those 30 or 45 minutes. We need to provide the advance warning to warn people in advance of what's oncoming and slow them down. The construction sites, the advance warning and DOT regulations that are involved in that are in place to make sure that the workers that are working in those construction zones are safe at all times. So we need to take a card from that, look at how can we make sure that we provide the greatest protection. One of the things that happens oftentimes, you see it on video and stuff like that, is the fact that PD, the law enforcement officers, and the fire department tend to have two different philosophies. Fire department wants to close the road, police department wants to keep the road open. Okay. One of the things that we need to look at from an interpersonal dynamic standpoint is why did that become the way it is? Okay. I was doing a class in a town for which the police chief was a volunteer firefighter, and during the class, we talked a lot about take a lane plus one for blocking, if the scene deemed necessary to make sure that we provided protection and safety for us, closing the road completely. And you could see where the police officer mentality made the person a little bit fidgety. And the reason behind that was their personal beliefs through training and policy and procedure from a law enforcement side is twofold. A patrolman's job when they go to the police academy is to protect the public with laws, protect the public from violence, crime, etc. But when they look at the patrolman's job from traffic patrol, it's instilled in them and drilled into them. Keep the traffic moving. Keep the traffic moving. They even have work projects on highway speeds, average traffic count, and how long is this travel lane or this road going to be closed, and what is the backup, and what is the concern for traffic not moving. To include, if it's in a major city, what is the dollar loss for the lack of use of that roadway. So you can see where officers are reluctant to close a roadway due to the fact that they've pretty much been drilled into them, keep the traffic moving. Okay. Now, if you take the mentality of an accident scene investigator from the police department standpoint, when they pull up in their car, and they look through the windshield, and they start to size up the accident scene, they are looking at evidence protection or preservation, and they're looking at their personal safety, knowing that they're going to take that road and close it and operate in it for the next 2, 3, 4 hours. We all understand that when we have a fatal accident or serious bodily injury, and they call up the accident reconstruction team, that incident has now closed that road for a long period of time. The mentality that they have is they don't want firefighters moving evidence or destroying evidence. They want to preserve the scene. They cordon it off. They don't want the traveling public driving through the debris, skid marks, anything that potentially could corrupt the police department's findings on what caused the accident. A simple kicking of a headlight bezel or a car part out of the roadway so that the traveling public can now use the roadway potentially could have detrimental effects on the police department's investigation. They have capability of understanding what the weight is of a headlight bezel. They see the impact point. They measure from impact point to where the bezel came to rest, and they can then work from there back what the travel speed was of that vehicle. That's just one component of everything that they can do to identify travel speeds, who was traveling in what direction, and what the actual impact speed was, point of impact. Okay, so you look at a patrolman's philosophy, they want to keep the road open. You look at the investigator's philosophy, they want to keep the road closed. You look at the fire department's philosophy, we want to provide protection for our personnel for 30, 45 minutes until we get the patients out of the car, they've been extricated, they've been put in the ambulance, and they're transported to the hospital. Now, in my state, the RSA, which is the laws that we are governed by, 154.7, specifically stated in the past that the fire department, senior fire official, superseded the law enforcement when the fire department deemed an accident on the roadway was a hazard to the general public and that we needed to have an emergency operation, meaning rescue, vehicle on fire. Okay, so we previously had the powers to go tell the police officer, we're closing the road and you got nothing you can say about it. In the recent three or four years, the law for 154.7 has been rewritten to include that the senior fire official and the senior law enforcement official that's on duty and at the accident scene are going to work in concert under the unified command system so that both officials have the same regulatory power to make a decision on whether or not we're going to open or close the roadway. Okay? So, from that standpoint, we have to then sit down with the police department and say, look it, when we go to an accident scene and I have to provide extrication on a patient, we need a certain amount of space, we need a certain amount of time, and I don't want to have any one of our responders injured. I don't want to see any law enforcement officers injured from post-secondary collision. I'm looking for 30 minutes. I want to close this road for 30 minutes. Can you figure out the alternative traffic pattern for 30 minutes? Okay? And then the new law affords us with the luxury of then looking at who's the senior supervisor. It could be the police chief in a local town, or it could be a captain in a larger municipality that's riding around in a supervisor's vehicle. It provides the luxury of the incident commander walking up to that supervisor and saying, look, here's our plan. I need to make sure that we protect our personnel. This is what we're doing. I need to close roads for this certain amount of time. It looks pretty serious here anyway. You're probably going to call the accident reconstruction team. Supervisor's going to understand the accident reconstruction team's mentality is protect the road, preserve the evidence, keep the road closed. So they now have afforded us the luxury in regulatory law to provide us with an open means of communication. They've kind of forced us to communicate with the PD and what we want to do. A lot of the stuff that we see on the internet, whether it's the news, YouTube videos or personal vehicles, videos that people have videotaped at accident scenes with law enforcement and the fire department having a confrontation, all comes down to poor communications. So we need to make sure that we communicate our intent, what our policies and procedures are before we have an accident. It just takes the department heads to meet, potentially take all the supervisors to meet, and have a class on highway safety. And highway safety class that you have that I'm talking about here, there's many, many videos. There's many, many more case studies of law enforcement officers being struck at accident scenes than there are fire department personnel. And that has a lot to do with how they work and how they operate without having blocking protection, without having multiple vehicles, without having the high-vis vest, even though now they're supposed to wear them. Case studies in the past have always had patrolmen without them. Okay, so keep that in mind. Back to the safety benchmarks. Use traffic cones or illuminated flares where appropriate for sustained highway incident traffic control and directional control. Okay, if we don't have a deemed hazmat, we don't have any fluids leaking, getting out some flares is a good idea at the beginning of the taper. If we don't have the advance warning fluorescent signage, then we'll use flares. We need to have a way to capture the general traveling public's eye, slow them down, identify the hazard, identify the block, identify the taper. Establish a fire department member assigned to the flagger function to monitor approaching traffic and activate an emergency signal if the actions of a motorist do not conform with the established traffic control measures that were in place for the incident scene. Okay? This doesn't mean stand out in the roadway with a flag. If we have the advance warning signage, we have the correct number of cones, and we have the correct taper and the block, that this person could be well off the roadway, and if they see a car blow through all those signage long before they strike the engine, they should have a radio so that they can key the mic over the radio and say, heads up down below, you got one coming in that's striking the back of the apparatus. Okay? So those are the safety benchmarks that are in place off this sample SOG. If you don't have an SOG for your department, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. You know, please go to respondersafety.com. Sample SOGs right there. Videos right there. Signage right there. There's visor cards for number of cones, for the travel speed, for the distances, the typical number of steps it takes to get to those certain distances. Reach out to your highway department. Get cones. Get enough cones. If you can't fit them in a compartment, bungee cord them to the rear bumper. I've seen firefighters engineer PVC tubing on a plate and bolt the plate to the back bumper, and then you can stand the cones onto the PVC so that you have plenty of cones on the back of the engine. It doesn't necessarily have to be inside. Okay. Once again, traditionally wise, we don't want to see cones on fire trucks, but that's not going to protect firefighters in the future. We can even go one step further. I'll give Grand Rapids, Michigan kudos. They had three rear-end collisions each time striking the back of a ladder truck. It was a tower ladder that they positioned as the block vehicle on the throughway. And this vehicle was struck three different times protecting the firefighters in that department for a total cost of damage of about $150,000. Luckily that the damages were mostly covered by insurance, but insurances did not reimburse them for lost time usage, and I'm sure a $500,000 aerial ladder, tower ladder, that's sitting in a repair shop being fixed could be well used at the next chimney fire, the next building fire, or the next high-angle rescue where they need to get up high. So the monetary value of vehicle insurance, yeah, sure, it's paying for the damages. Unfortunately, firefighters have lost usage. Okay, it did its job. So what did Grand Rapids, Michigan do? They reached out and looked at how they could make a way to provide the block and protection without damaging their aerial ladder or their ladder truck. They came up with a plan. They got a dump truck from their highway department, which was planning to send that off to auction. And the firefighters worked on repainting it and getting it to look like a fire department vehicle with the reflective tape on it. And then they went out and purchased a crash attenuator, which is a trailer that you pull behind the dump truck, and it looks like a large sled. This is designed to take a rear-end impact and decrease the G-forces that are involved in that impact, thus protecting the traveling public, as well as providing protection for the firefighters at the accident scene without damage to a critical fire department piece of apparatus. Stationed at the same place that the fire department had their aerial ladder, cross-manned for accidents where that crew would get in that vehicle and bring it up onto the highway. In that vehicle, there's some videos on the internet of cars striking those things head on and people surviving. Very similar to the soft walls in the NASCAR design. This thing's designed to take a hit. It is designed to take multiple hits, so it wasn't as though they needed to repair a vehicle each and every time. But if it did get struck, they didn't have the loss of use of a key component in their fleet. Okay. All right. Well, we're right on time. We're at an hour and 45 minutes, and we're winding down. So I think we're going to call it a night. I just want to remind everyone that that Tap the Box and tonight's show on emergency vehicle responder safety was brought to you by me, the host, Billy Greenwood of FETC Services. And if you guys are looking for material to beef up your training program, looking to increase your policies and procedures, there's no reason to reinvent the wheel. Just go to www.respondersafety.com, and everything you need is there in one website. So, all right, with that said, Tap the Box is the creation and sole opinion of the show's owner, me, Billy Greenwood of FETC Services. All rights reserved, all personal opinions expressed or implied are just that, my personal opinion, and not that of Fire Engineering, Fire Engineering Training Blog Network, the Penwell Corporation, any agency, any association, fire department, or municipal fire department organization for which I or any of our guests are associated with. With that said, Tap the Box and FETC Services would like to say thank you to all the listeners that were out there tonight, and especially to the callers who called in to be part of our show. Stay tuned for our next show. It's scheduled on Wednesday, December 21st, 2011. And hopefully I'm going to have Dave LeBlanc on. He's the author and contributor of The Backstep Firefighter and A View from the Front Right Seat. Dave has got some really thought-provoking ideas that really make firefighters stand up and think. So Tap the Box would like to end the show, as we always do, with this one last passing thought. A great man once said early in my career to remember to say I love you to the ones that you love each and every time you leave to start a new tour. May God watch over the brotherhood and sisterhood tonight who are currently protecting the citizens of your community. God bless all the men and women of the United States Armed Forces. Without your commitment and dedication to protecting our freedom, we would not be able to produce such a show. When you see a soldier or a veteran in passing, please reach out and shake his or her hand and tell them thank you for serving. God bless the USA. This is Tap the Box, and we're out of here. Have a good night. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Fire Engineering Talk Radio.